As we were studying the display, a man, lean and lavishly bearded in the Darwinian style, said good day and asked how we were doing. He identified himself as Dr. Phil Alderslade, curator of Selenterates. Jellyfish and corals, he added at once, seeing our expressions of frank ignorance. I noticed you taking notes, he added further. I told him of my devotion to box jellyfish and asked him if he worked with them himself. Oh, sure, he replied. So how do you keep from getting stung? Basic precautions, really. You wear a wetsuit, of course, and rubber gloves, and you just take a good deal of care when handling them, because if even a tiny piece of tentacle is left on a glove, and you accidentally touch it to bare skin, wiping sweat from your face or brushing away a fly or something, you can get a very nasty sting, believe me. Have you ever been stung? Once, he said. My gloves slipped and a tentacle touched me just here. He showed us the soft underside of his wrist. It bore a faint scar about half an inch long. Just touched me, but geez, it bloody hurt. What did it feel like? We asked together. The only thing I can compare it to is if you took a lit cigarette and held it to your skin, held it there a goodish long while, maybe 30 seconds. That's what it felt like. You get stung from time to time by various things in my line, and I can tell you I've never felt anything like it. So what would a couple of yards feel like, I wondered. He shook his head at the thought of it. If you tried to imagine the worst pain possible, it would be beyond that. You're dealing with pain of an order of magnitude well past anything most people have ever experienced. He did something you don't often see a scientist do. He shivered. Then he smiled cheerfully through his extravagant facial hair and excused himself to get back to his corals. We left the museum and headed out of town through Darwin's sunny, orderly suburbs, white bungalows on tidy lawns, and at the edge of town passed a sign that said, Alice Springs, 1,479 kilometers. Ahead, along the lonely Stuart Highway, lay nearly 1,000 miles of largely unrelieved emptiness all the way to Alice Springs. We were on our way into the famous and forbidding Never Never, a land of dangerous heat and bone-white sunshine. The road, the track, as it is still sometimes called, was nearly empty but straight and well-maintained. Ask 10 people in Sydney or Melbourne whether the highway from Darwin to Alice Springs is paved or not, and most will have no idea. In fact, it was paved long before most other outback roads. During World War II, when Northern Australia became a principal staging area for the Pacific Campaign. These days it carries a small but growing number of tourists, a very little local traffic, and lots of road trains, multi-trailered trucks up to 150 feet long, which haul freight between the most distant outposts of Australia. To meet a barreling road train coming at you full throttle on a 2-lane highway, on which it desires all of its lane and some of yours, is a reliably invigorating experience. An explosive whoomp as you hit its displaced air, followed at once by a consequent lurch onto the shoulder, several moments of hypermanic axle action sufficient to loosen dental fillings and empty your pockets of coins, an enveloping shroud of gritty red dust, and the metallic dinks and savage thumps of flying rocks, some involuntary oral emissions on your part as the dust clears and you spy a large boulder dead ahead, and a sudden miraculous return to tranquility and smoothness as the car regains the pavement entirely of its own volition and continues on its way to Alice Springs. The only time that this part of the world had any life at all was during World War II, when 60 airfields and 35 hospitals were built along the highway between Darwin and Daly Waters, and 100,000 American troops were stationed in the area. The sites are still indicated with historical markers, and a couple of times we pulled off to have a look. When Alan Moorhead passed this way for Rum Jungle, a decade after the war's end, most of the buildings were still standing. Sometimes he came across abandoned planes and stacks of munitions quietly decomposing in the desert. I naturally hoped we would as well, but there was nothing out there now, nothing but stillness and oppressive heat and a sense of being in the midst of a boundless nullity. In every direction, for as far as the eye could see, the earth was covered with spinifex, a brittle grass which grew in clumps so closely packed as to give an appearance of verdure. It looked like land that could support 1,000 head of cattle an acre. In fact, Spinifex is useless, the only wholly non-edible grass in the world, apparently. It is also murder to travel through, because its needle-sharp points, tipped in silica, break off when brushed and become embedded in the skin, where they fester into small but horrible sores. Scattered among the spinifex were turpentine bushes and man-sized termite mounds, which stood in the desert like ancient dolmens. And that was it. After about 3 hours, we passed through Catherine, a dusty, inoffensive little community, and the last town worthy of the name for 400 miles. Beyond it, the landscape grew more visibly impoverished, and the traffic thinned out from little to almost none. For much of the way, the highway was simply a taut line connecting impossibly distant horizons, the landscape on either side a monumental emptiness, punctuated by spinifex, low bushes, lunar rocks, and almost nothing else. The sky everywhere was huge and brilliantly blue. We had been driving for perhaps 90 minutes in a largely mindless silence when at last Alan spoke. He said, "How are you off for urine?" "I have all I need, thank you. Why do you ask?" "It's just that I notice we're nearly out of petrol." "Truly?" I leaned over to confirm that Alan could indeed interpret a petrol gauge, if not perhaps quite as frequently as one might wish. "Interesting time to notice, Alan," I observed. "This thing just seems to suck up fuel," he replied, perhaps just a trifle inadequately. "So where are we?" he asked after a moment's further reflection. "We're in the middle of nowhere, Alan." "I mean in relation to the next town." I looked at the map. "In relation to the next town, we are," I looked again just to confirm, "in the middle of nowhere." I did some measurements with my fingers. "We appear to be about 40 kilometers from a dot on the map called Larima." "And do they have petrol there?" he asked. "One sincerely hopes so. And do you think we have enough to get there?" "One sincerely, and if I may just say, bloody well hopes so." We chugged into Larima on the last vapor of gas. It was an all but dead hamlet, but it did have a gas station. While Alan fueled up, I went in and purchased a stock of bottled water and snack foods for future emergencies. We vowed that henceforth we would jointly keep a steady eye on the fuel gauge and not let it dip below the halfway mark. There were even greater stretches of emptiness to come. Still, the very slight brush with crisis buoyed our spirits, and we were in a triumphant frame of mind when in late afternoon we rolled into Daly Waters, our destination for the day. Daly Waters, 370 miles from Darwin, 570 from Alice Springs, was off the Stuart Highway a couple of miles down an unpaved side road and over a small ford, which added to its already palpable sense of remoteness. If you were looking for a classic outback spot, you could not improve upon it. It consisted of a few small houses, a tumble-down and obviously long-closed general store, 2 gasoline pumps unattached to any particular building beneath a sign saying Outback Servo, and a utilitarian pub with a tin roof. All the rest was heat and dust. We parked outside the pub. It had signs hung all over it. One said, "Established 1893, Australia's oldest licensed public house." Nearby another said, "Established 1930, Northern Territory's oldest pub." The heat when we stepped from the car was stifling. The temperature must have been pushing 110. A tourist brochure I had picked up in Darwin hinted, without actually saying, that the Daly Waters pub provided accommodation. I certainly hoped so, as we were 230 miles from the next town, with nothing but a scattered and uncertain assortment of roadhouses in between. Anyway, it's dangerous to drive through dusk in the outback. That's when kangaroos come bounding out of the gloaming and into the paths of passing vehicles, to the frequent regret of both. Trucks sweep them aside, but they can make a mess of cars, and sometimes the car's occupants. We stepped into the gloomy interior, gloomy because the world outside was so painfully bright, and we had been out in it all afternoon. I could hardly see a thing. "Hello?" I said to a face behind the bar that might, for all I could tell, have been a ping-pong paddle. "Do you do rooms?" "Finest rooms in Daly Waters," responded the paddle. "Also the only rooms in Daly Waters." As the form spoke, it transmogrified before my eyes into a cheerfully sweaty, bespectacled, slightly harassed-looking man of late middle years. He was sizing us up with a look that was very slightly askance. "You want 2 rooms," he said, "or are you bunking up together?" "Two," I said at once. This seemed to please him. He rummaged in a drawer and produced 2 keys with unmatching tags. "This one's a single," he said, laying a key on my palm, "and this one's got a double bed in it, in case one of yours gets lucky tonight." He bounced his eyebrows in a slightly salacious manner. "And do you think that's likely?" "Hey, miracles happen," he said. The rooms were in a separate block that stood alongside the pub, 10 or so of them ranged on either side of a central corridor. I insisted Alan take the double bed, as he was far more likely to get lucky than I was. "Out here," he gave a hollow laugh. "There's 80 million sheep in the outback, Alan. They can't all be picky." We parted to examine our rooms. Basic was the word that leapt to mind. Mine consisted of an ancient bed, a battered dresser, and a raffia wastebasket. There was no TV or phone, and the illumination consisted of a bare yellow bulb dangling from the ceiling. But the solitary window held an ancient air conditioner, which shook and juddered violently when switched on, but did actually seem to generate a little cool air. The bathroom was at the end of the corridor, and was a touch insalubrious, with rust stains in the sink and a shower that looked actively infectious. I went to visit Alan, who was sitting on his bed, grinning inanely. "Come in," he cried. "Come in. I'd offer you something from the minibar, but I don't seem to have one. Pull up a chair." "Oh, no, there is no chair. Well, please make full use of the wastebasket." "It is a little basic," I conceded. "Basic? It's a bloody cell. I'd show you the light, but it's burnt out." "I'm sure we can get a replacement for you," I said. "No, no, no. I think I like it better in full darkness." He pursed his lips. "Is it too early to start drinking?" I looked at my watch. It was only 4:45. "It is a bit," I said. "There's actually something I wanted to see." "An attraction? In Daily Waters? What can it be? Someone getting petrol? The evening sheep shag?" "It's a tree," I said. "A tree? Of course it is. Please lead the way." We went out to the car and drove a couple of miles down a hot dirt track. There, on the edge of a large barren clearing beside the road, stood a sign announcing that we had found our way to the Stuart Tree, commemorating John McDougall Stuart, perhaps the greatest of all Australian explorers. A Scottish soldier of bantamweight dimensions, he barely topped 5 feet, Stuart led 3 epic expeditions through the interior and all but killed himself in the process. The bright light of the outback severely disagreed with his vision, and on at least 2 of his trips he was soon seeing double. Not perhaps the most encouraging affliction in someone choosing a route through an uncharted wilderness. "So, boys, which of those twin peaks do you think we should head for? I say we go for the one under the left-hand sun." Generally, he would finish the trips effectively blind. On his 2nd expedition, he also became crippled with scurvy, for which he seemed to have a particular susceptibility. His body became a mass of sores that will not heal. The skin, one of his lieutenants noted, hung from the roof of his mouth, his tongue became swollen, and he was incapable of talking. Virtually insensible, he was carried on a stretcher for the last 400 miles, and each day his colleagues lifted him down, expecting to find him dead. Yet within a month of returning to society, he was on his feet again and setting off once more into the punishing void. His final attempt, in 1861 and 62, seemed fated to end in failure as well. His horses were much distressed for want of water, and both men and beasts were tormented by bullwaddy, a treacherous shrub with thorny spikes. But at Daily Waters they found a stream with potable water. It was the moment that saved the venture. The men rested, rewatered, and pushed on. In July 1862, 9 months after setting off from Adelaide, they reached the Timor Sea, and in so doing became the first to find a practical route through the heart of the continent. Within a decade, a telegraph line had been strung from Adelaide to what would eventually become Darwin, putting Australia at last in direct touch with the world. In his delight at finding the stream at Daily Waters, Stuart carved an S into a big gum tree. It was this that we had come to see. The tree, it must be said, was not much. A 15-foot-high chunk of gum tree, lopped of its upper branches and long dead. Every guidebook tells you the S is clearly visible, but we couldn't find it. Still, there was a certain pleasure in being at a famous spot that few Australians visit. As we stood there, a flock of galahs, a noisy pinkish parrot, came and settled on the surrounding trees. It was a scene almost entirely without feature. A barren plain, a fat setting sun, a scattering of ragged gum trees. And yet, in a wholly uncharacteristic way, I was captivated by it. I don't know why, but I loved it out here. We regarded it for quite a time, then Alan turned to me and asked in a respectful voice if we could go for a drink now. "Yes, we can," I said. Daly Waters' fame did not begin and end with the fleeting visit of Stewart and his band. In the 1920s, a rather shadowy couple by the name of Pierce came to Daly Waters and opened a shop with a borrowed £20. Amazingly, they did pretty well. Within a few years, they had a shop, a hotel, a pub, and an aerodrome. Daly Waters became a stop-off point between Brisbane and Darwin on the run to Singapore and on to London in the early days of Qantas and the old Imperial Airways. Lady Mountbatten was among the first overnight guests at the hotel. Goodness knows what she made of the place, though I dare say she was just awfully glad to be on solid ground. In the early days, a commercial flight from London involved, in addition to nerves of steel, 42 refueling stops, up to 5 changes of aircraft, and a train journey through Italy because Mussolini wouldn't allow flights through Italian airspace. It took 12 days. As well as the seasonal monsoons, the flights were subject to dust storms, mechanical failures, navigational confusion, and occasional pot shots from hostile or impish Bedouins. Crashes were not infrequent. The perils of aviation in the period are neatly encapsulated in the experience of Harold C. Brinsmead, the head of Australia's Civil Aviation Department, in the first days of commercial aviation. In 1931, Brinsmead was on a flight to London, partly for business and partly to demonstrate the safety and reliability of modern air passenger services, when his plane crashed on takeoff in Indonesia. No one was seriously hurt, but the plane was a write-off. Not wanting to wait for a replacement aircraft to be flown in, Brinsmead boarded a flight on the new Dutch airline, KLM. That flight crashed while taking off in Bangkok. On this occasion, 5 people were killed, and Brinsmead suffered serious injuries from which he never recovered. He died 2 years later. Meanwhile, the surviving passengers carried on to London in a replacement plane. That plane crashed on the return trip. Daly Waters claims to be Australia's oldest international airport, though I suspect many other venerable airstrips make a similar boast. It is certainly true that it was used as a stop-off point on some international flights, and more regularly on cross-country flights from Queensland to Western Australia, so it was a kind of crossroads. The airport stayed open until 1947. The pub opened in 1938, so it is not by any stretch the oldest in the outback or the Northern Territory, but it is certainly one of the most extraordinary. As with most outback pubs, every inch of interior surface, walls, rafters, wooden support posts, was covered with mementos left by earlier visitors. College ID cards, driver's licenses, folding money from many nations, bumper stickers, badges from various police and fire departments, even a generous and arresting assortment of underwear, which dangled from rafters or was nailed to walls. The rest was nicely Spartan, a large but basic central bar, concrete floor, bare tin roof, an assortment of tables and chairs of different vintages and styles, a battered pool table. At the bar, 7 or 8 men, all in shorts, t-shirts, boots, and bush hats, stood drinking stubbies, squat bottles of beer, served in insulated foam holders to keep them cold. They all looked hot and dusty, but then everything in Daly Waters was hot and dusty. The atmosphere in the pub can best be described as convivially sweltering. Even standing still, the sweat dripped off us. The windows had screens, but most were full of holes, and anyway the doors were wide open so flies came in freely. The men at the bar gave me compact but friendly nods as I bellied up to the bar, and obligingly made space for me to stand to order, but showed no special interest in me as an outsider. Clearly, as the souvenirs attested, visitors were not a novelty. I acquired a pair of chilled stubbies and conveyed them to the table, where Alan sat beneath a bumper sticker commemorating a visit by the Where the Fuck Are We Touring Club. Alan was suffused with a strange happiness. "You like it here," I said. He shook his head with a kind of speechless delight. "I do. I actually do." "But I thought you hated it." "I did," he said. "But then I was sitting here looking out the window at the setting sun, and it was lovely. I mean, really quite astoundingly lovely. And then I turned and saw the bar with all these outback characters, and I thought, bugger me, I like it here." He looked at me in the frankest wonder. "And I do. I really like it." "I'm so pleased," I said. He drained his beer and rose. "You ready for another?" Now it was my turn to be filled with wonder. I started to point out that it was a touch early to be setting such a blistering pace. But then I thought, what the hell? We had come a long way, and this place was, after all, built for drinking. I drained my bottle and handed it over. "Sure," I said. "Why not?" Well, I can't pretend I remember a great deal of what followed. We drank huge amounts of beer. Huge amounts. We ate steaks the size of catcher's mitts. They may actually have been catcher's mitts. And washed them down with more beer. We made many friends. We circulated as if at a cocktail party. I talked to ranchers and sheep shearers, to nannies and cooks. I met fellow travelers from around the world and talked for some time to the proprietor, one Bruce Caterer, who told me the complicated story of how he had come to own a pub in this lonely and far-flung spot, of which confidence I have not the tiniest recollection, and certainly nothing approximating a note. As the evening wore on, the bar grew almost impossibly crowded and lively. Where all the people were coming from, I couldn't guess. What was certain was that there were at least 50 cheerfully committed drinkers tucked away in the bush in the vicinity of Daly Waters, and at least as many visitors like us. I got comprehensively beaten at pool by at least 14 people. I bought rounds for strangers. I called my wife and professed my lasting devotion. I giggled at any story told me and radiated uncritical affection in all directions. I would have gone anywhere with anyone. I awoke the next morning fully clothed and on top of the bedding, with no clear memory past the catcher's mitt portion of the evening and a head that felt like a train crash. I pressed my watch to an eyeball and groaned at the discovery that it was nearly 10 o'clock. We were hours late if we were ever going to get to Alice Springs. I stumbled down to the bathroom and put myself through some cursory ablutions, then found my way blearily into the pub. Alan sat propped against a wall with his eyes closed, a cup of black coffee steaming untouched before him. There was no one else around. "Where, coffee, where?" I croaked in a tiny voice. He indicated vaguely with a weak hand. In a side room I found an urn of hot water and containers of instant coffee, tea bags, powdered milk, and sugar with which to make a hot beverage. I loaded a cup half full with instant coffee powder, dribbled in some water, and rejoined Alan. Weakly, in the manner of an invalid, I lifted the cup and introduced a little coffee to my lips. After a couple of more sips, I began to feel a little better. Alan, on the other hand, looked terminally wretched. "How late were we up?" I asked. "Late." "Very late?" "Very." "Why are you sitting with your eyes closed?" I asked. "Because if I open them, I'm afraid I'll bleed to death." Did I disgrace myself? I peered around the room to see if my boxer shorts were draped from any rafters. "Not that I recall," he said. "You were shit at pool." I nodded without surprise. I often use alcohol as an artificial check on my pool-playing skills. It's a way for me to help strangers gain confidence in their abilities and get in touch with my inner wallet. "Anything else?" I asked. "You're doing a house swap next summer with a family from Korea." I pursed my lips thoughtfully. "North or south?" I asked. "Not sure." "You're making this up, aren't you?" He reached over and plucked from my shirt pocket a business card, which he presented to me. It said, "Park Ho Lee, Meat Wholesaler," or something, and gave an address in Pusan. Underneath it, in my own handwriting, it said, June 10th through August 27th, no worries. I placed the card, folded once, in the ashtray. I think I'd like to get out of here now, I said. He nodded, and with an effort of will rose from the table, wobbled ever so slightly, and went off to gather up his things. I hesitated a long moment and followed. 10 minutes later, we were on our way to Alice Springs. Chapter 16. Now here's a story to ponder. In April 1860, during the second of his heroic attempts to cross Australia from south to north, John McDougall Stewart reached the almost waterless center of the continent, roughly halfway between the present sites of Daly Waters and Alice Springs. 1,000 miles from anywhere, the spot was the very climax of desolation, as Stewart's fellow explorer Ernest Giles once nicely put it, and Stewart and his men went through hell to get there. They were sick and ragged and half-starved, and it had taken months, but at least they had the satisfaction of knowing that they had become the first outsiders to penetrate to the brutal heart of the continent. So you may imagine Stewart's surprise when, in the middle of this baking nowhere, he and his party encountered 3 Aboriginal men who greeted them by making a secret sign of the Freemasons. Stewart didn't say in his journal what the sign was, but it was clear from his amazed description that it was unlikely to have been coincidental. Then a few days later, Stewart and his men found horse tracks following a natural course across the plains. Finally, some distance farther on, the explorers were setting up camp for the night when some people from the Warramunga tribe approached. One of Stewart's party, a young man named W.P. Auld, was sitting with his boots off, rubbing his aching feet, when one of the Warramunga men knelt before him. While Auld watched bemusedly, the man replaced the boots on Auld's feet and carefully but deftly tied the laces for him, then sat back with a big, pleased smile. It was painfully evident to Stewart that he and his men were not, in fact, the first white people to reach the empty center of the country. So who preceded them? No one has ever had the faintest idea. I mention this to make the point that the outback is an odd and unfathomable place. There is something about all that emptiness that exerts a strange hold on people. It is an environment that wants you dead. Yet again and again, in the face of the most staggering privations, for the meagerest of rewards, explorers ventured into it. Sometimes, as Stewart found, they didn't even bother to leave their names. It is almost not possible to exaggerate the punishing nature of Australia's interior. For 19th-century explorers, it wasn't just the inexpressible heat and constant scarcity of water, but 1,000 other miseries. Stinging ants swarmed over them wherever they rested. Natives sometimes attacked with spears. The landscape was full of thorny bushes and merciless spinifex, whose silicate pricks nearly always grew infected from sweat and dirt. Scurvy was a constant plague. Hygiene was impossible. Pack animals grew frequently crazed or lost the will to go on. Ernest Giles recorded in his memoirs how his horse once grew so delirious after an unsuccessful search for water that when they returned to camp at the end of the day, the animal plunged its nose into a campfire in the deluded hope that it would provide relief. In pity, Giles gave the animal a drink from his own meager supplies, but it died anyway. Even camels could barely cope with the desert conditions. In Beyond Leichhardt, A History of Australian Exploration, Glenn McLaren notes how blowflies doted on the wounds of camels, laying eggs in any raw lesions, which soon erupted in horrible swarms of wriggling maggots. On one expedition, a camel's wound grew so infected that the maggots were scooped out daily with a pint pot. Eventually, the animal just lay down and died. When even camels can't manage a desert, you know you found a tough part of the world. For human and animal alike, nearly every breathing moment was a living hell. And yet, over and over, the explorers returned. Nearly every expedition of the 19th century started off with some ostensible practical purpose: to find a route for a telegraph line, to look for gold, to uncover some zone of hidden promise. But almost without exception, the explorers soon became transfixed by the emptiness. unable to resist its allure, they just pushed on and on. Perhaps no one suffered privations more willingly and repeatedly, to less effect, than Ernest Giles. In 1874, while traveling with a companion named Alfred Gibson through the barren wastes of Western Australia, Gibson's horse died. Giles gave Gibson his own mount, with instructions to follow their tracks 120 miles back to a place called Fort McKellar to fetch another. Gibson lost his way in the emptiness and was never seen again. The area is now called the Gibson Desert. Left to find his own way back on foot, Giles staggered for days over exhausting sandhills, the last 60 miles with almost no water. It was while in this desperate state, tormented by flies and half-dead with hunger, that he famously spotted a baby wallaby and fell upon it, devouring it raw, fur, skin, and all. These were not exceptional experiences, you understand. This is what awaited you when you went into the outback. When Robert Austin and his men, lost in the featureless wastes of Western Australia, drank their own and their horses' urine, there was nothing terribly unusual about that. Lots of people did likewise in the desert. When Giles found and devoured the baby wallaby, he thought himself exceedingly lucky. Not just at that moment, but for years afterward. "The delicious taste of that creature I shall never forget," he wrote with sincere and telling enthusiasm in his memoirs. Stuart and his men retained equally fond memories of a time, on the brink of starvation, they found a clutch of dingo puppies and boiled them up in a pot. "They were," he wrote, "delicious." Why people repeatedly subjected themselves to such ordeals is a mystery that surpasses understanding. Despite the extreme travails he experienced on the fatal expedition with Gibson, Giles returned almost at once to his compulsive wanderings. Stuart did likewise. Almost continuously for 4 years, he hurled himself at the unyielding interior, until he succeeded in breaking through. Worn out by the effort, he retired to London and died soon after. It is impossible to say who endured the greater hardships, Stuart or Giles, but there is no question that Giles did it for less reward. No explorer was ever unluckier. In the same year that he lost Gibson in the desert and stumbled 120 miles through appalling heat, Giles also explored the central regions around the area known as Eulara. One day he struggled up a small rise and was confronted with a sight such as he could never have dreamed of finding. Before him, impossibly imposing, stood the most singular monolith on earth, the great red rock now known as Uluru. Hastening to Adelaide to report the find, he was informed that a man named William Christie Goss had chanced upon it a few days ahead of him and had already named it Eyre's Rock in honor of the South Australia governor. Eventually, too old to explore, Giles ended up working as a clerk in the goldfields of Coolgardie, where he died in obscurity in 1891. Today, he is almost completely forgotten. No highway bears his name. And so the doughty Mr. Sherwin and I proceeded through the hot and inexhaustible desert. As we proceeded south from Daly Waters, the landscape became more sparsely vegetated. It began to feel eerily as if we had left planet Earth. The soil took on a reddish glow, more Martian than terrestrial, and the sunlight seemed to double in intensity, as if generated by a nearer, larger sun. Even on a smoothly paved highway, in the comfort of air conditioning, you are not entirely robbed of the sense of what the explorers must have gone through. The discomforts can't be fully imagined, but the scale can, and it was awesome. To the left were several thousand square miles of stubbled nothingness called the Barkly Tableland, which eventually merges into the Simpson Desert, probably the toughest ranching country in the world. So unyielding is the land that ranches have to be vast to support a single operation. The largest of them, at a place called Anna Creek, is bigger than Belgium. To the right, unbelievably, the land was even harsher. This was the infamous Tanami Desert, an area of hellish dryness that even now is almost entirely uncharted. On my map, not a feature was indicated, not a dried creek bed or old dirt track, for 300 miles to the Western Australia border. Beyond that, it was virtually as bleak for 600 miles more. Even along the Stuart Highway, with its life-bearing traffic, the 550-odd miles between Daly Waters and Alice Springs could boast just one small town, an old gold-mining community called Tennant Creek, three or four clustered habitations that made Daly Waters look cosmopolitan, and a roadhouse perhaps once every 80 miles. And that was it. I had never been out in such a boundless blank. Eventually, some hills began to rise in the middle distance, the MacDonald Ranges. Very occasionally, once or twice an hour, a road train would bomb past. Once, we saw an approaching car, the driver evidently sedated by monotony, leave the road and bang wildly along the rough shoulder for perhaps 200 feet, pulling in his wake a long speed ramp of dust. As he neared us, stirred possibly by Alan's honking, the driver jerked to startled wakefulness and veered reflexively, but much too sharply, for the pavement, and thence, to our shrill amazement, into our path. It was absurd. In an area of inexpressible emptiness, the only two pieces of moving metal were about to bang together in a very big way. There passed an instant made up in equal parts of horn blare, muted shrieks, and wild tight swerves. For the strangest moment, time went into a rest, and I could see perfectly our unwitting assailant, frozen as if in a candid photograph, looking at us with a mixture of bewilderment and apology. I shouldn't wonder that it's a moment all people are given when they're about to die suddenly. Then all was blurred swiftness again. The cars passed without hitting, goodness knows how, and I turned full in the seat to watch our adversary shooting away into the distance behind us, soberly attentive to his lane. I watched until he was a dot at vanishing point, then turned to Alan. "Well, I don't know about you," he said brightly, "but I'm ready for a cup of coffee and a change of underpants." "Excellent plan," I agreed, and I joined him in scanning the horizon for a lonely but welcoming roadhouse. The great virtue about driving through a great deal of emptiness is that when you come to anything, anything at all, that might be called a diversion, you get disproportionately excited. In mid-afternoon we saw a signpost for something called the Devil's Marbles, and, with the briefest exchange of glances, followed a side road a mile or so to a parking area. And there we saw something really quite fabulous. Enormous piles of smooth granite boulders, many as big as houses, stacked in jumbled piles or scattered over an immense area, 1,800 hectares, according to a signboard. Every one brought to mind something else, a jelly bean, a bread roll, a bowling ball, except that they were immense and often perched on impossibly fine points. Imagine a boulder maybe 30 feet high and nearly spherical, standing on a base little larger than, say, a manhole cover. Needless to say, there wasn't a soul around. Put these stones anywhere in Europe or North America, and they would be world famous. In every family album would be a photograph of Mom and the kids having a picnic against a backdrop of fantastic rocks. Here they were a lost wonder, off the road in the middle of a boundless nowhere. We wandered around for half an hour, as amazed by the solitude as much as by the rocks, then congratulated ourselves on our good fortune and good sense in stopping, and returned to the road in a state of elevated contentment. 10 hours and 903 kilometers after leaving Daly Waters, we arrived, dry and dusty, in Alice Springs, a grid of ruler-straight streets set like an enormous helipad on a plain beside the golden slopes of the MacDonald Ranges. Because it is so bang in the middle of nowhere, Alice Springs ought to seem a miracle, an actual town with department stores and schools and streets with names. And for a long time it was a sort of antipodean Timbuktu, a place tantalizing in its inaccessibility. In 1954, when Alan Moorhead passed through, Alice's only regular connection to the outside world was a weekly train from Adelaide. Its arrival on Saturday evening was the biggest event in the life of the town. It brought mail, newspapers, new pictures for the cinema, long-awaited spare parts, and whatever else couldn't be acquired locally. Nearly the whole town turned out to see who got off and what was unloaded. In those days, Alice had a population of 4,000 and hardly any visitors. Today it's a thriving little city with a population of 25,000, and it is full of visitors, 350,000 of them a year, which is, of course, the whole problem. These days you can jet in from Adelaide in 2 hours, from Melbourne and Sydney in less than 3. You can have a latte and buy some opals, and then climb on a tour bus and travel down the highway to Ayers Rock. The town has not only become accessible, it's become a destination. It's so full of motels, hotels, conference centers, campgrounds, and desert resorts that you can't pretend even for a moment that you have achieved something exceptional by getting yourself there. It's crazy, really. A community that was once famous for being remote now attracts thousands of visitors who come to see how remote it no longer is. Nearly all guidebooks and travel articles indulge the gentle conceit that Alice retains some irreproducible outback charm, some away-from-it-all quality that you must come here to see. But in fact, it is anywhere Australia. Actually, it is anywhere planet Earth. On our way into town, we passed strip malls, car dealerships, McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets, banks and gas stations. Only a scattering of Aborigines strolling along the dried bed of the Todd River gave any hint of exoticism. We took rooms in a motor inn on the edge of the modest downtown. My room had a balcony where I could watch the setting sun flood the desert floor and burnish the golden slopes of the McDonald ranges beyond. Or at least I could if I looked past the more immediate sprawl of a Kmart plaza across the road. In the 2 million or more square miles that is the Australian outback, I don't suppose there is a more unfortunate juxtaposition. Alan was evidently held by a similar thought, for a half hour later when we met out front, he was staring at the same scene. "I can't believe we've just driven 1,000 miles to find a Kmart," he said. He looked at me. "You Yanks have a lot to answer for, you know." I started to protest, in a sputtering sort of way, but what could I say? He was right. We do. We have created a philosophy of retailing that is totally without aesthetics and totally irresistible. And now we box these places up and ship them to the far corners of the world. Visually, almost every arrestingly regrettable thing in Alice Springs was a product of American enterprise, from people who couldn't know that they had helped to drain the distinctiveness from an outback town, and doubtless wouldn't see it that way anyway. Nor, come to that, I dare say, would most of the shoppers of Alice Springs, who were no doubt delighted to get lots of free parking and a crack at Martha Stewart towels and shower curtains. What a sad and curious age we live in. We strolled through the center of town looking for somewhere to eat. Alice's central business district was sufficiently compact that it took little time to exhaust its modest possibilities for sustenance and diversion. When we realized that we were walking the same streets twice, we repaired, more or less by default, to a Chinese restaurant we had passed a few minutes earlier from the other direction. It was nearly empty. While we waited for our food, Alan gazed critically at the flock wallpaper and gaudy fixtures, as if these alone might explain Alice's disappointing inadequacies. For a moment he seemed even to be gazing at the background music. "So how long are we here for?" he asked at last. "Well, we're here tomorrow, and then we go to Uluru, and then we come back here for a day, and then you fly back to England." He nodded thoughtfully. "So 2 days here altogether." "Yup," I said. "And what is there to do for 2 days in Alice Springs?" "Quite a lot, in fact," I said encouragingly, and pulled out a brochure I had taken from a rack in the motel. I flipped through it. "There's the Alice Springs Desert Park, for one thing." He inclined his head a fraction. "What's that?" "It's a nature reserve where they've carefully recreated a desert environment." "In the desert," he said. "Yes. They've recreated a desert in the desert. Have I got that right?" "Yes." "And you pay money for this?" "Yes." He nodded contemplatively. "What else?" I turned the page. "The Mecca Date Garden." "Which is?" "A garden where they grow dates." "And they charge money for this as well?" "I believe so," I said. Is that it, or is there more? Oh, much more. I went through the list of other attractions. The old telegraph station, Frontier Camel Farm, Old Timers Folk Museum, National Pioneer Women's Hall of Fame, Road Transport Hall of Fame, Minerals House, Chateau Hornsby Winery, Sounds of Starlight Theater, Strello Aboriginal Research Center. Alan listened intently, sometimes requesting a soupçon of elaboration, and considered all this for some moments. Then he said, "Let's go to Ayers Rock." I thought for a moment. "Yeah, all right," I said. And so in the morning, we rose early and set off for mighty Uluru. Alice Springs could wait. Uluru and Alice Springs are so inextricably linked in the popular imagination that nearly everyone thinks of them as cozily proximate. In fact, it is almost 300 miles across a largely featureless tract to get from one to the other. Uluru's glory is that it stands alone in a boundless emptiness, but it does mean that you have to really want to see it. It's not something you're going to pass on the way to the beach. That is, as it should be, of course, but it is equally a fact when you have just completed a 1,000-mile passage through barren void, you don't really require another 5 hours of it to confirm your impression that much of Central Australia is empty. Well into the 1950s, Ayers Rock was inaccessible to all but the most dedicated sightseers. As late as the 1960s, the number of annual visitors was no more than 10,000. Today, Uluru gets that many every 10 days, on average. It even has its own airport, and the resort that has sprung up to serve it, called Ulura, is the third largest community in the territory when full. Ulura stands a discreet and respectful dozen or so miles from the rock itself, so we stop there first to get rooms. It consists essentially of a lazy loop road, along which are tucked a range of accommodations, from campgrounds and a youth hostel up to the most sumptuously deluxe of resort hotels. With nothing better to do, we had passed much of the 5-hour drive working out a program for ourselves for our stay. Essentially, this had established that we would spend the afternoon studying the rock in a calm and reflective manner, then divide whatever remained of the day between a cooling dip in the hotel pool, drinks on a terrace while watching the setting sun gorge the rock with the red glow for which it is famed, a little stroll through the desert to stretch our legs and look for dingoes, wallabies, and kangaroos, and finally a dinner of refinement and quality beneath a sky of twinkling stars. We had, after all, just driven 1,300 miles in 2.5 days. If ever anyone was entitled to a little desert R&R, it was us. So there was a certain real excitement as we turned off the highway and entered the cosseted confines of Ulura. We went first to the Outback Pioneer Hotel, which sounded moderately priced, if dangerously likely to have chandeliers made of wagon wheels and an all-you-can-eat buffet for people in baseball caps. In fact, it proved on approach to be rather grand and clearly very nice, but unexpectedly busy. Stacks of luggage were being unloaded from 2 tour buses out front, and there were people everywhere, nearly all white-haired and pear-shaped, standing around squinting or fiddling with cameras and video recorders. Alan dropped me out front, and I trotted inside to inquire about rates. I was amazed at the amount of hubbub in the lobby. It was early afternoon on a weekday out of season, and the place was a circus. The check-in area brought to mind a mustering station on a foundering cruise ship. I asked a guy at the concierge desk what was going on. "Nothing in particular," he said, joining me in considering the unattractive chaos. "It's always like this." "Really?" I said. "Even out of season?" "There is no out of season here now." "Are there any rooms here, do you know?" I asked. "Afraid not. The only place with rooms left is the desert gardens." I thanked him and hied back to the car. "Problem?" said Alan as I climbed in. "Very poor dessert selection," I said, not wishing to alarm him. "Let's try the Desert Gardens Hotel. It's much nicer." The Desert Gardens was vastly more swank than the Pioneer Outback, and mercifully less crowded. Only one person, a man of about 70, stood between me and the check-in clerk. I arrived just in time to hear the clerk say to him, It's $353 a night. I swallowed hard at this. We'll take it, said the man, in an American accent. How big is it? I beg your pardon. How big is the room? The clerk looked taken aback. Well, I'm not sure of its dimensions exactly. It's a fair size.
What's that mean, fair size?
It's amply proportioned, sir. Would you like to see the room?
No, I want to sign in, the man said shortly, as if the clerk were needlessly delaying him.
We want to get to the Rock.
Very good, sir.
As he signed in, he asked a million subsidiary questions. Where was the Rock exactly? How long did it take to get there? Was there a cocktail lounge in this hotel? Where was that exactly? What time was dinner served? Could you see the Rock from the dining room? Was it worth seeing the Rock from the dining room? Where was the pool? Through which doors? Which doors? And what about the elevator? Where was that?
Where?
I looked at my watch unhappily. It was getting on for 2 o'clock, and we didn't even have rooms yet. Time was speeding away.
So is it good, this Rock?
The man was saying in what might have been an attempt at levity.
I beg your pardon, sir.
The Rock, is it worth coming all this way?
Well, as rocks go, sir, I think you could say it's first class.
Yeah, well, it had better be, the man said darkly. Then his wife joined him, and to my dismay, she began asking questions. Was there a hairdresser's? How late was it open? Where could they mail postcards? Did the gift shop accept traveler's checks? These were U.S. dollars traveler's checks. Was that okay? And how much are postage stamps for America? Is there an iron and ironing board in the room? Where did you say the gift shop is? And what about my brain? Have you seen that anywhere? It's about the size of a very small walnut and never been used. Eventually they shuffled off and the clerk turned to me. With a regretful air, he informed me that the gentleman ahead of me had taken the last room. There might be dormitory space at the youth hostel, he said, and allowed this deeply unappealing proposition to sit there for a moment. Shall I check?
Yes, please, I murmured.
He consulted his computer and looked suitably doleful. No, I'm afraid even that's full now. I'm sorry. I thanked him and went out. Alan was leaning against the car with a hopeful face, which fell when he saw mine. I explained to him the situation. He looked crushed.
So, no swim, he said.
I nodded. No wine on the terrace. No sunset over the Rock. No elegant room with downy pillows. No complimentary fluffy bathrobe and tinkling minibar. The bathrobes never fit anyway, Alan. Not quite the point. He fixed me with a frank gaze. And instead of these things, we will be...
Driving back to Alice Springs, I said.
He removed his focus to the wider world while he allowed this thought to settle.
Well, he said at last, I suppose we'd better go and see if this bloody Rock is worth a 600-mile round trip.
It was.
The thing about Ayers Rock is that by the time you finally get there, you are already a little sick of it. Even when you are 1,000 miles from it, you can't go a day in Australia without seeing it 4 or 5 or 6 times. On postcards, on travel agents' posters, on the cover of souvenir picture books. And as you get nearer the Rock, the frequency of exposure increases. So you are aware as you drive to the park entrance and pay the ambitiously pitched admission fee of $15 a head and follow the approach road around that you have driven 1,300 miles to look at a large, inert, loaf-shaped object that you have seen photographically portrayed 1,000 times already. In consequence, your mood as you approach this famous monolith is restrained, unexpectant, pessimistic even. And then you see it, and you are instantly transfixed. There, in the middle of a memorable and imposing emptiness, stands an eminence of exceptional nobility and grandeur, 1,150 feet high, 1.5 miles long, 5.5 miles around. Less red than photographs have led you to expect, but in every other way more arresting than you could ever have supposed. I have discussed this since with many other people, nearly all of whom agreed that they approached Uluru with a kind of fatigue and were left agog in a way they could not adequately explain. It's not that Uluru is bigger than you had supposed, or more perfectly formed, or in any way different from the impression you had created in your mind, but the very opposite. It is exactly what you expected it to be. You know this rock. You know it in a way that has nothing to do with calendars and the covers of souvenir books. Your knowledge of this rock is grounded in something much more elemental. In some odd way that you don't understand and can't begin to articulate, you feel an acquaintance with it, a familiarity on an unfamiliar level. Somewhere in the deep sediment of your being, some long-dormant fragment of primordial memory, some little severed tail of DNA, has twitched or stirred. It is a motion much too faint to be understood or interpreted, but somehow you feel certain that this large, brooding, hypnotic presence has an importance to you at the species level, perhaps even at a sort of tadpole level, and that in some way your visit here is more than happenstance. I'm not saying that any of this is so. I'm just saying that this is how you feel. The other thought that strikes you, that struck me anyway, is that Uluru is not merely a very splendid and mighty monolith, but also an extremely distinctive one. More than this, it is an extremely recognizable one, very possibly the most immediately recognizable natural object on Earth. I'm suggesting nothing here, but I will say that if you were an intergalactic traveler who had broken down in our solar system, the obvious directions to rescuers would be, go to the third planet and fly around till you see the big red rock. You can't miss it. If ever on Earth they dig up a 150,000-year-old rocket ship from the galaxy Zog, this is where it will be. I'm not saying I expect it to happen, not saying that at all. I'm just observing that if I were looking for an ancient starship, this is where I would start digging. That's all I'm saying. Alan, I noted, seemed similarly affected. It's weird, isn't it? He said. What is? I don't know, just seeing it. I mean, it just feels weird. I nodded. It does feel weird. Quite apart from that initial shock of indefinable recognition, there is also the fact that Uluru is, no matter how you approach it, totally arresting. You cannot stop looking at it. You don't want to stop looking at it. As you draw closer, it becomes even more interesting. It is more pitted than you had imagined, less regular in shape. There are more curves and divots and wave-like ribs, more irregularities of every type than are evident from even a couple of hundred yards away. You realize that you could spend quite a lot of time, possibly a worryingly large amount of time, possibly a sell your house and move here to live in a tent amount of time, just looking at the rock, gazing at it from many angles, never tiring of it. You can see yourself in a silvery ponytail, barefoot and in something jangly and loose-fitting, hanging out with much younger visitors and telling them, and the amazing thing is that every day it's different, you know what I'm saying? It's never the same rock twice. That's right, my friend. You put your finger on it there. It's awesome. It's an awesome thing. Say, do you by any chance have any dope or some spare change? We stopped at several places to get out and have a look, including the spot where you can climb up it. It takes several hours and much exertion, which comfortably eliminated it from our consideration, and in any case the route was closed for the afternoon. So many people have collapsed and died on the rock that they close it to climbers when the weather is really warm, as it was this day. Even when it's not too hot, lots of people get in trouble from fooling around or taking wrong turns. Just the day before, a Canadian had had to be rescued after getting himself onto some ledge from which he could not either get up or down. Since 1985, ownership of the rock has been back in the hands of the local Aboriginal people, and they deeply dislike visitors, whom they call Minga, or ants, clambering all over it. Personally, I don't blame them. It is a sacred site to them. I think it should be for everyone, frankly. We stopped at the visitor center for a cup of coffee and to look at the displays, which were all to do with interpretations of the dream time, the Aborigines' traditional conception of how the Earth was formed and operates. There was nothing instructive in a historical or geological sense, which was disappointing because I was curious to know what Uluru is doing there. How do you get the biggest rock in existence onto the middle of an empty plain. It turns out, I looked in a book later, that Uluru is what is known to geology as a Bornhart, a hunk of weather-resistant rock left standing when all else around it has worn away. Bornharts are not that uncommon. The Devil's Marbles are a collection of miniature Bornharts.